Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is September 9th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Well, we've got an outstanding doubleheader tonight. First, all on swine flu. First, we have Dr. Laura Thompson on health issues. Then attorney Ellen Phillips is returning to talk a little bit more about the legal issues. It's really a terrific team on the issues and the ones that impact you and yours and the actions you can take. And that's always what it comes down to. What's the action? What can we do? We recorded Dr. Thompson on Monday, so we're going to be playing a recording. I wanted her to meet with I have a Soleri Circle that meets by bridge call on Mondays. It's people coming in from all over the country, from Oregon, California, North Carolina, from everywhere. And they helped me develop the questions they wanted to get most answered for themselves and their families. And so we're going to play that after I go through money and markets and respond to some of the Ask Catherine questions. So I was so amazed at the sort of quality and specifics of her advice that we typed up an outline of the presentation and put it online, and you can link to it from your control panel. So you may want to download that, and it'll just help you take notes. And we thought it would save you time so you could listen and not worry that you weren't going to get it all down or you'd have to go back and listen again. Okay, tonight's, because we have two guests, tonight's Soleri Report is going to be an hour and a half, so we should end at about 10:30 Eastern time, and that's about 9:30 Central time and then 7:30 Pacific time. So the topic is important, and I really wanted to take the time. My theme tonight is get ready, get ready, get ready. We are in what is an economy and the market's a slow period. The last week of August coming into Labor Day, particularly in the United States, because of the holidays, is always a time when people are at the beach and not ready to, you know, it's a vacation time. They're not ready to address the issues that all get packed into Washington and Wall Street in September and October. September is traditionally not a good time for the stock market, usually traditionally a very good time for precious metals. We've seen, if you look at the charts we posted today, you'll see the action in gold has been quite interesting in the last couple days. Significant money moving into gold ETFs. The spot price tried to ascend to the 1,000 mark and backed off and is now at 991, but clearly tremendous action in the precious metals market. And so we're coming into a time when the pig has to go through the snake in many, many ways, politically and economically. And so this, as I've predicted, this fall is a time when expect the unexpected and protect your time. This is a period when our time could be wasted and the surprises could be very time-consuming. Let me just talk about five stories of what happened over the last week, which I think is really important. One, I would call, or a group of them I would call Asian power shifts. We saw a very important election change in Japan, extraordinary shift in the power and party, and a signal of very different policies. It could have a dramatic impact on the relationship with the U.S. The Japan and Japan Central Bank have been critical to financing and keeping the dollar up with the yen carry trade. So election in Japan could signal major changes. Hong Kong announces today that they are moving their gold out of London to a new facility in Hong Kong, essentially moving their gold stores out of the protection of the British Navy and under the protection of the Chinese military. Now, remember, Hong Kong switched back from the Brits to China in 1997, so it's taken almost 12 years to now change the gold stores. But that's a very important signal of the rise of Asian power. We have also threats that have been sort of spooking the market that state-owned enterprises in China reserve the right to walk away on underwater derivative contracts if that should happen it could send a real ripple off in the derivative markets and in the financial system globally. All of those are symptoms and signals of the shift in economic power to Asia from the United States. That's something that's been happening for a long time. We're the ones who've been shifting the capital out and financing it. So whenever anybody says China does this or that, I always say, well, who is China? Since, you know, the huge amount of the capital that's gone into finance this shift is coming from North America. Second very important story, and all these are all covered on the blog, and if you want to learn more, please go to the blog, is a Swiss bank put out an investment commentary to its clients after the final announcements on the UBS deal. It's the oldest Swiss bank operating continuously in Switzerland, put out an investment commentary called Farewell America. The wonderful guys at Zero Hedge got a copy, put it up on their website, so we were able to pilfer one, put it up on ours, and put it up today. You can read it. It is an excellent fundamental analysis of why U.S. securities are seriously overpriced relative to securities in Europe and other parts of the world. And great perspective. It says a lot of things. I wrote an article about Andrew Cuomo in 2006. When he was running for Attorney General in New York, and I'm regarding the fact that if we're deemed to be completely without law, it will have devastating impact on our financial markets. And essentially, they're saying the same thing. They point out that Bill Gross, who runs PIMCO, the largest bond fund or bond management operation in the country, and Warren Buffett both indicated in a variety of different statements recently, Buffett in an op-ed article in New York Times, that the dollar in the United States was in for real trouble, and they refer to this. I just wanted to read this. That section of the report is titled Rats Leaving the Sinking Ship, and rats is their term for Bill Gross and Warren Buffett, and I think it's more than appropriate. They say, without in any way wishing to over-dramatize matters, we do believe that such signals should be taken seriously. In exactly the same way as it is inadvisable to ignore rats leaving a sinking ship, for they often know the crucial aspects of the ship better than the captains and the officers. The least worst outcome that we can expect for the USA and for the Treasury in particular is significantly higher financial costs for debt incurred in the future. We calculate the middle-term contributions by the American tax authorities to this added expense as a result of the keep foreigners out strategy described above at about 50 basis points. And this is precisely the Obama administration's miscalculation. Their aggressive attitude to tax exiles will generate extra funds, perhaps running into billions, but the price they pay will be exorbitant. An increase in the credit spread of 50 basis points on total public debt of over $10 trillion U.S. dollars represents increased costs of $50 billion per annum. The sums don't work. To make up for this would require additional taxable funds of some $2 trillion U.S. dollars. What he's pointing out is that that the UBS action will help generate more revenues in income, but will they predict, so raise the cost of capital that the net result at the end of the day will be a significant loss for the Treasury. Two things that come out of this report that we're going to see more of in the future coming from European and Asian investors are they really underscore two things, the deterioration in the federal credit and the fundamental lawlessness that we're experiencing in the United States. The first can be dealt with. There are many, many ways to deal with our debt. However, they can't be dealt with in a lawless environment, and hence what they refer to is that our enduring power is military. So this report is a real shot across the bow from Europe to the United States, and I would encourage you to take a look at it because it, in terms of overall perspective, it's very good. Third story, continued decline in the economy despite Wall Street Journal and others announcing recovery and some kind of ease. What we're seeing is unemployment continues to rise. The president of the Atlanta Fed admitted that real employment is 16%. That story is up on the blog. we see reports of significant insider selling in the stock market, and really program and intervention is the trading that seems to be holding it up. It's, we saw the markets drop a little bit over the last few trading days, up a little bit today, but tremendous weakness under the sort of the guise of the kind of institutional trading that seems to be holding it up. And finally, today we had a broadcast from John Williams from Shadow Stats, which we put up on the blog, that really helps to paint the picture of real softening in the economy, continued softening in the economy. The fourth thing I wanted to point out, I've posted the U.S. debt clock several times on the blog. I posted it again this week because it tells a very important backdrop story to what's going to be happening this fall. If you pull it up, it's usdebtclock.org. What you'll see at the very top of it is 12, it counts the total U.S. debt at a number of $11 trillion rising to $12 trillion, which is about $38,000 per citizen. If you look at the current spending rate, which is cash, not accrual, what it shows is we're adding dramatically to that number every year, probably add another $4,000. If you drop down and say, okay, what are the big components in the budget, it shows they have several counters for that. And what it shows is on one side you have, or on either side, you have interest on the national debt and the military expenses. So it's kind of the bankers and the war machine. And they're running neck and neck with Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And when I describe September and October as the time when the pig has to go through the snake, what I mean is we have a federal budget process, the new budget being due on October 1st. And the question is the bankers, the war machine, and Social Security and Medicare Medicaid are all coming into that channel to continue to allow all of them to grow together means you have the ability to, you need to have the ability to borrow more money globally. Meantime, we have the creditors, China, Europe, screaming, no, you know, you've got to get your fiscal house in order. And so we see the real push arising to try and reconcile the two in some kind of way. Now, if you go down the debt clock, one of the next counters you'll see is the bailout money. And what you realize is the bailout is estimated to cost now another $12 trillion, almost the equivalent of our entire debt from the beginning of the, you know, from the Revolutionary War through all the different wars, including World War II. So all of our debt from the beginning of time is now, you know, approximately the same amount as we've bestowed on the banks in the last year and a half or 2 years, a stunning number. And that number is sitting out there as a contingent liability that could cause the debt per person to go up even more. If you drop all the way down at the bottom of the U.S. debt clock, what you'll see is a calculation of the unfunded liabilities for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And what you see is that number is $191,000 per person. So more than, five to six times what the debt per person on the stated debt is. Now, what that's saying is we've promised the baby boomers a huge amount of resources to support their retirement and their health care in old age. And over the last 10 to 15 years, what we've done between the money that's been shifted out of the country, the missing money, which I've documented, the bailouts, et cetera, part of what the financial coup d'etat is all about is taking all the resources we put behind the boomers and shifting it out. So what you see when you look at the U.S. debt clock is you see a beautiful sort of mathematical framework to show you what the Obama administration and Congress is facing. They're facing the question of they've got, on one hand, they've got the creditors. On the other hand, they've got the bankers and the military complex who are necessary to keep the creditors in accord and doing what we need to do. And then they've got the people whose costs are now rising dramatically. And the question is, how can you reconcile this? Well, of course, there are many ways you can reconcile of them, some of them very positive. Because when you look at those numbers show economics within the matrix. And, of course, solution number one is, well, let's just change the boundaries of the matrix. Let's unsuppress all this incredible energy and healthcare knowledge and technology that we know exists. Earlier or later last week, I put a link to a wonderful documentary on the life of Royal Rife. If you're not aware of the extent to which healthcare costs could drop if technology was, you know, which is known and available, was unsuppressed, absolutely see the documentary and learn about the story of Royal Rife. It's a beautiful example, and I'm going to keep doing that. So the real solution is to just change the boundaries of the matrix. If you don't change the boundaries of the matrix, then you have a few ways to get out of this problem. One of them is to cut benefits dramatically. Another is to abrogate the federal debt. And finally, the last is just to inflate your way out. Now, given the signs that the dollar may be falling over the next year and even slowly being replaced as a reserve currency, if that is what happens, it looks like the inflation route is probably the most likely. But what concerns me about the whole story that the U.S. debt clock tells is you look at it and it makes much more sense to that the administration and the powers that be would want to exercise dramatic controls, you know, as in martial law, of the population, because when people lose benefits either through inflation or through simply changing the deal, there can be extreme kinds of political problem. And so what we've been watching is what I call the search for the control excuse. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this doubleheader, because we've seen lots of indication that swine flu is really being used as a pretext to get the kind of control economically and politically that somebody might like to have as the boomers start to realize the extent to which our wealth has been stolen or transferred. Coming up after Labor Day, we have very significant Treasury auctions. Those will be how the Treasury market and the fixed income market respond to those auctions is going to be a very important signal about how things are going to go in September and October. This weekend, we have a meeting of the G20 policymakers in London. It's building up to the big Pittsburgh summit in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on September 24th and 25th. And so watching those conversations is going to be important, because we know the BRIC nations are rising. G20 is the place where they really come to the table, and we'll see a lot of arguing between the BRIC nations, so to speak, and Europe and North America, or I should say Western Europe and North America. And also the sort of challenge that they all have is how do you keep global liquidity and the global economy going. So keep an eye on those. So a lot to look at, and September is going to be a very interesting time. My prediction is change is going to accelerate. And how quickly, I don't know. I still believe we're going to be in a slow burn. We'll be doing our quarterly wrap-up on October 1st, so that's going to be an important one to listen. I think it's really important, just in closing out money and markets, to realize that when we look at a lot of the behavior of the leadership, it's behavior of people who are in a very insecure position, particularly vis-a-vis the boomer generation. The opportunity for us boomers is we have an opportunity to reinvent ourselves and with our reinventing ourselves, reinvent America from the inside out. There was a wonderful study came out from the Kauffman Foundation, posted on the web, and it talked about the coming boom in America, predicting that the boomers would start businesses, et cetera. So the story's not over, and whereas the sort of the pro-centralization team is feeling insecure, I think it's time for the pro-decentralization team to start feeling secure and taking action, because this is our time, really, as things as things spiral down, they also open up. We have an opportunity for real change and to have a positive impact. Now, ask Catherine. I had a wonderful question that I'm gonna start to answer tonight, but I'm gonna be answering it again and again for many weeks because I think it's a really good one. The person said, "Where are the business opportunities? I want you to talk a lot more about this." Okay, so let me just start the conversation about where are the business opportunities in this. Where you have good local and state relations, there is a real opportunity to start looking through the state and local government budgets, which are going to be in real pressure, and start to ask the question, where can our state and local government save money by doing something locally? So the example that I've used several times on the Solari Report and we're going to be using in our workshop in Hohenwald in the third week of September is the example of the food stamp contract in Tennessee. We have people in Tennessee on food stamps. We've got about 1 million people in Tennessee on food stamps. It costs about $1 billion a year to provide those food stamps. The data servicing and customer service contract support has been outsourced to JP Morgan Chase in India. And so Tennessee is, on one hand, paying people in India to do customer service for a person on food stamp who needs a good job. So in essence, if you look at the human resources budget of Tennessee and the federal government, we, the taxpayer, are paying somebody to live who can't find a job while we're paying another person to do a job to provide customer support to them. So clearly there's an opportunity to shift some of that money and jobs back. For those of you who've read the story about Edgewood Technology Services that I talked about starting a data servicing company in a low-income neighborhood in the 1990s, there is many, many people who can learn to do high-quality administrative data servicing and support jobs who are often on welfare or food stamps or in many of these different programs. And it's especially good for people who can't afford to commute for a variety of reasons, need to be near children or elderly parents. And it offers all sorts of opportunities for people in rural areas who really don't have a lot of choices. I was just talking on a radio show in North Dakota. They had a big plant shut down. How do you reinvent yourself quickly? How do you generate income? Well, if a local area can organize and say, wait a minute, we can do these jobs for a state or local government, and the net result to your budget, it's going to cost us more to do them than the folks in India, but then your social service costs drop dramatically, and the net result is it saves money for state and local governments. So where you have good local and state relations, there is real opportunities to start going through the budgets and finding ways where reengineering jobs locally is going to be far more economic. Now, if the dollar falls, it's even going to be more true. The more the dollar falls, the more sort of the outsourcing needs to get reversed. So the first thing I would start to do is to start to map your local financial ecosystems. I just want to give you one more example. I tell the story of my little town, Hickory Valley. This happened before I got here, and I've certainly heard of it happening in other towns. We were paying a large corporation to pick up our trash and realized when the contract came due that we could ask a local couple who the husband was familiar with waste issues. He works at the landfill. We could just arrange for the local couple to pick up our trash. You know, it's a part-time job for two of them. And so, you know, it's thousands of little things like that, but they're all there. So one, I would look for reverse engineering outsourcing opportunities, and I would focus on areas where the communications between citizens and the state and local government can be very positive, and citizens are creating real solutions for state and local government. That's number one. Number two, I would look for areas where privatization is being considered, and rather than let an outside corporation who has no sympathy with my area come in and buy out of government very important strategic local assets, I would get together a group of local investors. I'd try and engage with the state and local pension funds and other big investors in the area and see if we couldn't assert either state or local control over those assets. So privatization can be a relocalization. It doesn't mean that everything has to go global. In fact, if you need global partners, you can bring them in. So I would get proactive about local privatization. If it works, you then have the basis of doing a venture pool and all sorts of things you can do, like apprentice programs, to make sure that the local talent and the young people sort of relocalize, and instead of running off to the big cities or, you know, someplace else, get them working, you know, sort of for the hometown team and building up small business and making it much more professional in your area. So those are just a few ideas. If you haven't listened to the Solaria report we did with John Rubino, I really encourage it. It's about clean technology, because one of the areas I want to talk about is the importance of sort of shifting the boundaries on the matrix of applying new or suppressed technology to help people lower their costs of living in their home. George, your last, in the last Solaria report, talked about demonetizing, and a lot of that is the application of technologies that we haven't used. If the dollar falls this fall or the coming year, the opportunities in the area could be dramatic. So I encourage you to listen to that Solaria report with John Rubino on clean technologies. Quickly, Cliff High talked about some of the climate change issues over the next couple of years. We've had some subscribers ask questions about what are the good places to live. I have emailed those to Cliff, and I'll report as soon as I have answers. We also have a couple of questions for Dr. Laura Thompson, and I have emailed those and will report those as I get responses. Now, as I mentioned, so that's it for Ask Catherine. As I mentioned, we had Dr. Thompson recording this Monday with my Solaria Circle, and so I'm going to ask Gary, our wonderful engineer, to play that recording for you. And then I'm going to come back on to talk with Attorney Alan Phillips about the legal issues after we listen to Laura discuss the health issues. Again, I've posted an outline of Laura's comments on our website, and it's linked from your subscriber control panel. So if that saves you time and energy in sort of digesting this incredible information, I hope you go to the subscriber panel and access it. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Laura Thompson to the Solaria Report, who's been with us again. She is the CEO and founder of the Southern California Institute of Nutrition in Carlsbad, California, outside of San Diego, and is also, for more than a few years, has been my nutritionist. I am a very satisfied client of Dr. Thompson. She's been with us before on the Solaria Report, so hopefully many of you have heard her very wise advice, but she has agreed to help us tonight sort out the issues, the health issues on swine flu and the vaccination. And because this is such an important topic, I invited as well members of my Solaria Circle, first ever Solaria Circle, to join us this evening by bridge call to help ask Laura some questions. So Laura, are you with us?
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for doing this. I know, you know, all of the subscribers just, I can't tell you how much they appreciate this kind of advice, so we just really are glad you could do this.
I'm happy to do it. I really love the idea of helping people help themselves, you know, because that's pretty much what we're going to be talking about.
Good. Well, I think of you as really more than a nutritionist, a teacher, so this is something, there are going to be a lot of students on this one. So, with that, I wanted to introduce the first member of the Solaria Circle who's going to be asking questions, Court Skinner from Palo Alto. Court?
Hello. Okay. The flu season is coming up, which is, of course, why we're all interested in this. And my question is, what can we do now to build our immune systems in anticipation of this? And in anticipation of finding a way maybe not to have to take the vaccination.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's probably the most important question that anybody, you know, that's, you know, thinking about getting a vaccination or not wanting to get a vaccination can ask, because ultimately it's all about how do we build our internal army? How do we build our defense system so we don't need someone else's or some synthetic defense system? I mean, who says we need that? Can't we just do it ourselves? So I'd say there are probably two ways to go about it. How I think of building your internal army are you in a state where you're just, you know, preventative? So, in other words, there's nothing going on immune-wise negatively for you, and you just want to keep it that way. So that would be, you know, your sort of preventative approach. And then, of course, the other approach is if there is something going on immune-wise, if you tend to get sick a lot or if you are sick now or if there are any other infections, because that's something you have to think about, even if it's not the flu. Is it herpes? Is it shingles? Is there bacterial infection? Is it a vaginal yeast infection? Are there bladder infections, prostate infections, lung infections, asthma? You know, all of those indicate that that the immune system is not taking care of business. So that would really present a different picture. So I like to look at it two ways, in preventative and active. You know, and in other words, if something is in a state already, then there's one thing that you can do, and if you're not dealing with any of that, then it's pretty much more basic. So the first thing is, how do you build your defense system? There are so many different ways to build your defense system, and right now I'll tell you that I have a document on my website, or my webmaster's putting it up there tonight, actually, so that more of the detail can be there, because I couldn't possibly go over it all. What you can glean from reading is going to be a lot more than, you know, what I'm going to be able to say. But the categories are, first of all, stop putting the junk in your body. Stop making your immune system and your liver and your kidneys work so hard. So I know Catherine is a big proponent of this, and maybe most of you are too, but I always like to tell people, because I don't want to assume, go organic. You know, stop putting the chemicals in your body. Stop using foods with pesticides and hormones and preservatives and colorings and all that. That's really basic, but, I mean, some people could do that and really be good just doing that, because they haven't been before. And what an improvement a person could see if they stop bombarding themselves with that junk. Number two is avoiding sugar. Or avoiding other things that turn into sugar, which would be like alcohol. Because sugar depletes the immune system. And, of course, when we say sugar, I know that brings a lot of things to mind. It could be more than just, we're talking about, you know, there's white sugar. That's the main one I'm talking about. But, you know, certainly artificial sweeteners. And if you use a lot of other sweeteners like honey or maple syrup, I mean, those are okay periodically, but those kinds of things you don't want to be doing every day, because that just keeps depleting the immune system. And then, of course, you know, there are tons of other suggestions that you're hearing on the media now about, like, keeping your hands washed and all those sort of logical things. But one thing that nobody really talks about too much, except in the alternative medical world, is the digestive system, because ultimately 60 to 75% of our immune system is in the digestive tract. I know that sounds kind of bizarre, because, you know, we don't really think of our immune system housed in our gut. But there are these bodies called gut-associated lymphoid tissue, and you know, just to put it simply, there are immune bodies or substances around the spleen and in the digestive tract around the liver that actually do a lot of our defense work. And one of the ways to keep them supported is by using, for instance, like probiotics. Most of us have heard by now, Acidophilus is pretty much a household word. And, of course, you have other strains like Bifidus and, you know, there are Thermophilus and different other strains. But taking a probiotic substance with Acidophilus or Bifidus or, you know, an array of good bacteria is going to be one of the first orders of business for building your immune system and to start to build that those gut-associated lymphoid tissue bodies that I mentioned. Another thing that's very helpful, and this is really good for kids, it can be taken in a way that it tastes good. There are sprays. I have different products at my disposal, forms of colostrum. And, you know, it's no mystery that mother's milk is, you know, what builds the immune system of the child, and that's because of the colostrum. And, of course, we can buy now cow colostrum in different forms. You can even get it in a health food store in liquid form. But most people prefer just to take it in a capsule. And that is great for building the immune system in the digestive tract. Excellent an excellent antiviral for preventing flu. And then, you know, another thing is, I mean, I could go on and on, but we'd never get to the rest of the question. another thing that's really important that I want to mention now is keeping the lymph system flowing. And the lymphatic system is a system of vessels kind of like the circulatory system, except the circulatory system circulates the blood, where the lymphatic system circulates lymph fluid. And the lymph fluid is kind of like your garbage disposal system. It carries the waste away from the cells, which is really important because otherwise, you know, the cells would stay toxic and then we would degenerate very quickly. But it also carries white blood cells, and it's a major battleground for, you know, viruses and bacteria and that type of thing. The immune system cannot work properly without the lymphatic system flowing. And the thing about the lymph system is it doesn't have a heart like the circulatory system has to pump it. It requires your muscles to move. And this is why when people lay down for a long period of time, especially, say, someone who's older who maybe can't move or has had some kind of condition where they're sedentary, the lymph system doesn't move, and a person becomes inherently weak because of that and immune-wise weak. So getting the lymph system moving could be anything from exercise to having massage to trampolining to walking to skin brushing. There's lots of things that you can do for that. And really inexpensive stuff we're talking about here, things that don't cost you anything but your time. Not that your time's not worth something, but, you know, I like to give people things that can help empower them, things that you can do on your own that you don't have to buy or you don't have to, you know, get prescribed. So that's kind of a quick overview, and I'll cover more specifics on bolstering the immune system, you know, through the other questions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so our next question comes from David Vijay up in Oregon.
Hi, Dr. Thompson. This is David.
Hi.
Hi. I was really happy to hear what you said about probiotics because I consume kefir on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like I'm going into this in a pretty good state. But, well, let's say that we're successful in avoiding receiving the vaccination, but that we end up contracting swine flu. So what would you recommend as some natural remedies that we can use to fight the actual flu?
Okay, so that would really bring in the acute natural medicine cabinet, I guess you would say. We just talked about the preventative. Now we're going to the acute. So you want to look at the fact that a flu virus is a virus. So there are certain antiviral properties that botanicals have, herbals have, that some vitamins, like, for instance, vitamin D has. So there are products that are inherently antiviral that I'll mention. And then you also want to look at the fact that when you're in a state of having a flu, your body is inflamed. And one of the most important things that really occurs is the body becomes consumed with heat and becomes ext- extremely dehydrated. So if there was only one person, a person did if they had a flu, I would say, I know it sounds corny, we always hear keep hydrated. Well, I don't think people really know what that means, to keep hydrated. You know, they probably drink a lot of orange juice or something, but really the most important thing to do is to drink water. Keeping the cells hydrated helps the cells get rid of the stuff that's congesting the cells. So that's one thing. As far as vitamins are concerned, we have several, you know, antiviral properties going on with vitamins. First of all, the recent studies on vitamin D, which most of you probably know about, because I know most of you are probably more hip than to this stuff than, you know, the mainstream public, but vitamin D, I mean, has been studied a lot in the past 10 years. And hey, you go into your medical doctor's office now, and they prescribe vitamin D. Now, they may not prescribe the right type of D, but just the fact that they're telling you you should take a vitamin, I mean, that's a major step. And the reason for that is it's in the medical news. I mean, it's all the clinical studies, all the trials, and all of the university studies. It's incredible what they're coming out with now about it being anti-flu, antiviral. And now they're even selling vitamin D in dosages of potencies of like 1,000 IUs, where in the past it may be 100 or 200 IUs, and now it's 1,000. Some of my patients are taking 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 a day. So for someone who has an active flu, I would probably go with a minimum of 2,000 a day. I carry a couple vitamin Ds. You know, one of them is a drop, one drop equals 2,000 IUs. So that's fairly easy to find at most of your health food stores, too. And then you want to look at, of course, probiotics. You want to go for probiotics, whether it's an acute or a preventative situation, good bacteria products, because they have antiviral tendencies, Acidophilus, Bifidus, those kind of things. You always want to go for vitamin C. Linus Pauling many years ago, that's one of the main things that was found out about, you know, through his studies was the antiviral effects of vitamin C. The best type of vitamin C to get is a calcium ascorbate with an array of bioflavonoids in it. You don't want to go for your standard ascorbic acid or, you know, you want to go for something that's much better absorbed. And then you have botanicals that are, you know, antiviral, antibacterial. You have echinacea, you have golden seal. I'm sure most of you know about those. You have olive leaf extract. I would tend to put someone in an acute state probably on about 5 or 6 products. Sometimes they're powders, sometimes they're tinctures, and I find that when people have flu, they're more easily handle powders and liquids than capsules. I gotta take a sip of water. Excuse me a second. So that's why I like tinctures, because they could be dropped into a little bit of juice, or that you can just take them directly in the mouth through a dropper bottle. So olive leaf you can get in tincture form. Echinacea, golden seal you can get in tincture form. I carry products that I like, that I know that work really. I have to use things that work. Otherwise, you know, I don't feel very good about what I'm doing. So that's why I carry a certain type of, you know, I carry many, many, many different products, and I synergize people's programs. But if you were just going to buy something in a health food store, I would probably go for vitamin C, vitamin D, olive leaf extract, echinacea, golden seal. Usually can get those in a combo and a probiotic, and you'd be in good shape.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Next, Paul Ferguson, our treasurer from Massachusetts.
Dr. Thompson, thanks for doing this tonight. I saw a news clip recently that talked about the fact that up to a third of the nurses in the UK have said that they are going to avoid taking the swine flu vaccination, and that some of the scientists that were involved in developing the vaccine are also concerned about some of the potential side effects. And I was just, I don't really understand exactly what the risks are of taking the vaccination. So assuming that it can't be avoided or you need to get vaccinated for whatever reason or required to, what are the risks that are associated with the vaccine?
Well, what you want to look at is what are the ingredients. That's one way to look at the risks. And so, well, first of all, you have live viruses. So right there, I mean, they're weak, granted, but you have live viruses in these vaccines. So a lot of people get sick. I was watching a doctor interviewed this morning, very proud that he's being an example, and they haven't even finished the studies and the trials yet, but he's being part of the trial, which is like whacked out as far as I'm concerned. But he was so proud. He said, yeah, I didn't even get the fever. And the way he said it was like, it was, you know, expected that most people probably would. And so right there, it elicits some kind of immune response because there's, you know, a virus is coming into your body. And what you really got to wonder is the people that do not get the immune response, why is that? Because their immune system may be not up to it. And that would mean, you know, possibly that the virus may actually hurt them in ways that a lot of people don't realize. Because these viruses have an affinity for the nervous system. So you can actually get a virus in the nervous, deep in the nerves. You may not have a flu, you know, but it could affect you in other ways. And, hey, listen, I have, it came to me about 2 years ago when I had patients who had gotten flu shots, and they deduced themselves. Like one woman said to me, you know, about a month after I got a flu shot, I got a shingles outbreak. And she said, I thought that was kind of odd timing. And, you know, shingles is a virus. And I, about two or three other people said that to me. They either got shingles or they, like a week later, they got a herpes outbreak. Okay, so what happened? The body had layers of virus already there. An active virus came into the body, added to the load, and the person ended up manifesting that thing which, you know, they were most vulnerable to, which, you know, was either a herpes or a shingles outbreak. So these flu shots, and since then I've had probably 15 or 20 people who've had flu shots tell me that they've had some kind of outbreak of something else afterwards. So that's number one. Number two is, you know, these things are preserved. So they're preserved with chemicals. And, you know, not the least of which would be like aluminum and mercury. So you're getting, you know, you're getting bona fide heavy metals in your body, again, injected into, you know, and probably carried into the nervous system or to the brain. And so those things could wreak havoc, and who knows when. You know, it doesn't have to. Most of the time, I'd say, people don't realize what they're doing. You know, they're just adding this incredible toxic burden to the body, and they don't realize it because they're not getting a negative effect in the moment. And then you're looking at things like formaldehyde and polysorbate 80 and different types of other, I guess, preservatives that they use to make the whole thing work. You know, it's just a chemical soup, so to speak.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, Susan Johann from North Carolina.
Hi, Dr. Thompson.
Hi, Susan.
Well, it's clear to me I don't want to get this shot, but, and it may be clear to a lot of other people, but if in fact people are coerced or feel somehow threatened as though they, you know, there may be some sort of mandatory military mandate that says that you either do this or you end up in, you know, in a jail with 25 other people who also said that they wouldn't do it, and people then buckle down and agree that they will, in fact, get this shot, what could they do ahead of getting the shot, or maybe even after they get the shot, to mitigate any effects from this? Or is there anything, or are you just sort of, well, good luck?
Well,
feels a little bit overwhelming, the idea.
Yeah. You know, I don't like to buy into the fear thing, but after I read the bill that's in the Massachusetts Senate right now,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys have read about that, about, you know, if the governor in Massachusetts declares a state of emergency concerning an epidemic, then, and if you don't comply to getting the flu shot, then you can be fined $1,000 per day in jail time and blah, blah, blah. Now, the bill hasn't passed the House yet, but just the fact that those words were even written is
mm-hmm.
it's just ridiculous. And I can't imagine, as long as we're on that subject, that this country could actually pull off something so efficient as being able to get everyone vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a joke, by the way. But it isn't a joke, really.
Right.
Because it just, I just don't see how that can happen. People just make too many mistakes. But anyway, the point is, I think it's important. I'll tell you, personally, in the past 2 years, I started changing my own personal nutrition program. I never worked on my immune system before. Well, not as much as I am now, because I never got sick. You know, I haven't gotten a flu. My husband hasn't gotten a flu. Actually, we've been married almost 13 years, and neither of us have had a flu in that period of time. I think I had an almost cold twice, and he had, you know, something maybe three times or something, but nothing. And I was just talking to my assistant, Kathy, here, and we were marveling at working together for 9 years, and neither of us had been sick. And so I never really worked on my immune system because I just always trusted that I would go on like I am. But I have more in the past couple of years because I guess I've gotten a little bit more fearful because of all of the media blitz and just the fact that who knows who's going to perpetrate what on us. And so I constantly work on keeping the immune system strong. And that's going to be an individual thing. I mean, we can give general, like we did before, you know, earlier with David's question. We can give, you know, some general, take vitamin D, take vitamin C, you know, keep hydrated, vitamin A, you know, and taking things to bolster the immune system, keep the lymph system running smoothly. Those are all things that everybody should be doing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That should be all the time. And then if, perchance, it does look like the flu shot is going to be imminent, then I would beef that up even more and really work on getting the liver and the kidneys supported so that the body can effectively eliminate the toxins that are going to be coming in through the shot. So we're looking at getting the immune system strong with the immune support nutrients and substances, and then getting the detoxification pathways open, which would be your liver, your lymph, your kidneys, your lungs, your skin, and your bowel. You know, I know that sounds like a big job, but that's, you know, I can't not tell you that.
Mm-hmm. I have somebody just recently talked to me about liposomal vitamin C, and I'm wondering if there's any benefit.
Really good.
Do you?
I think liposomal vitamin C is very good.
Okay. I was wondering about that. Or, I mean, there are there are actually holistic doctors who will do a vitamin C drip or a vitamin B12 drip or something, and one wonders if that could be a benefit as well.
Yeah, actually, I mean, if someone had, you know, say, someone at their disposal who could give them what's called a Myers cocktail, it's a special combination of high-dose vitamin C, I mean, like 25,000 milligrams,
mm-hmm.
usually in a Myers cocktail, and other, you know, some minerals, calcium, magnesium, and it usually has glutathione for a liver detox. You know, a Myers cocktail, you know, once a week would be fantastic.
anybody knows a nurse who can, I don't think the nurses can order the ingredients of the IV, but they can give you the IV. So if you know a doctor who can order the nutrients and the nurse that give you maybe an IV a week, otherwise it's really expensive. I mean, I was just thinking maybe like a, if you knew a nurse that could do it in your home or something.
Right.
But that would be a great, that would be a great way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking outside the box.
Yeah. Well,
and then as far as post-vaccine, well, you know, I work with a lot of families, and the parents that I work with, you know, some of them are pretty vehemently against, you know, getting any of their family the vaccine, and others are scared not to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the, and especially parents, you know, they
oh, yeah.
feel terrible if they do the wrong thing. So they end up getting the vaccine because they just figure, well, everybody's doing this. How bad can it be?
Right.
And so then what we, and I don't like to weigh in on that. I just kind of like to tell them the basic, you know, information, and then they make their decision because that is an emotional decision that no one else can make. And then I just say, well, if that's what you're going to do, then time for vaccine detox. You know, a couple weeks after you've gotten the vaccine, then we start vaccine detox. And there are some very gentle homeopathics that I use. One actually is called vaccine cord that we use along with some lymphatic drainage homeopathics. Very easy to administer to children. Don't taste bad. Easy to take. Easy to remember. Very pleasant sort of protocol that helps to get the residues from the vaccines out of the system at a very deep level. So, and then also, Susan, what I said before, just keeping the bowels open, you know, making sure the person has got two bowel movements a day and is able to release the toxins that the liver is dumping into the bowel. Because if that's not happening, then that stuff is going to stay circulating in the bloodstream, get right back into the cells and or into the brain. And this is what we see with autism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those kids can't detoxify. So the vaccines end up affecting them in a way that it doesn't, that they don't affect other children.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, so it's keeping the liver supported, keeping the kidneys supported, and the bowels, making sure the bowels are moving. And then all the other things that I said, you know, before, keeping exercise, keeping hydrated, and choose your products for immune strengthening. I can do personalized programs for people. We can look, you know, go and look, do certain testing and see what is this person actually deficient in? Like we do a certain test that tests for vitamin C. Does this person really need vitamin C? You know, are there viruses already in the body? Some patients right now, I'm doing viral detoxes with them now so that when, you know, if this flu starts to spread, then they're not going to be as likely to catch it because their viral load is lower.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kinds of things that, you know, that I'd be looking at.
Right.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, and last, we have Carolyn Betts coming from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yay.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Paulson.
Hi, Carolyn.
I'm out in the Midwest, where in a very conservative city, where there are a lot of people who, you know, figure whatever the doctors say to do, they're going to do, and whatever the mainstream media says is a problem is a problem. And I'm kind of wondering what you think some of the best arguments might be that we can use to teach people around us why they should avoid the vaccinations if they have the opportunity to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm probably going to be a little redundant here, but I guess, you know, one of the things that I do with, especially with the families that I work with, because, like I said, that they're really in a fear mode and wanting to protect their children, is I always go for the logical. You know, what can you say that's logical? Then people will say, oh, well, that sounds logical. What are the ingredients? You know, look at the ingredients. I mean, people, you know, you'd go around the grocery store and you see people looking at the labels all the time. Nobody does that for their vaccines, you know. But I would get a hold of the ingredients, which we probably don't even know yet because they're still doing trials. But, you know, we have an idea because based on the past, you want to look at, oh, there's aluminum in this. There's mercury. There's polysorbate 80. There's formaldehyde. What the heck do I want to put this stuff in my body for? You know, that's number one. And, you know, number two is another part of the logic from my perspective. I know, probably giving away my age here, but, you know, this stuff used to be really logical. I don't know if it reaches people that way anymore. But, you know, we are strong. We have the ability to fight by ourselves. Who says we need something else just because some measly little flu comes around? You know? And so why do we go to this incredibly toxic chemical when we can actually build our immune system? And this is not even that virulent a problem. This virus is not that big of a deal. And so, I mean, all of that, it just makes so much sense to me. I don't know if it does to you, Carolyn. I'm sure it probably does to you, but you're probably wondering if it does, if it would to other people if you use that argument. Any comments? Well,
people have said to me, oh, well, they, you know, I brought up the Guillain-Barré problem that happened in 1976 when there was some flu vaccine. And people say, oh, but they do it differently now. It's all safe now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I also was interested to hear you say that there were live viruses. I thought they were using, like, parts of viruses or dead viruses.
That's even worse. Well, you know, we'll see. I don't really know what's going to be in the. I'm going to be very interested to see what the ingredients are going to be. But I, like I said, I'm just kind of going from the past.
Is it likely there might be a choice, like that there might be different vaccines, and that we might be able to pick one versus another?
You know what? I doubt it, because I think they're really scrambling right now. You know, I know they're trying to roll this thing out in mid-October, and that's scary, isn't it? I mean, to think that it's not even going to be properly tested, and the whole thing about being tested is such a sham anyway, but just from their perspective, not even properly tested. Oh, geez. I mean, to me, the best argument is this is not a really bad virus. They've admitted this. I've heard this many, many news shows. And so why is this such a big deal? I mean, why are you falling? Not you guys, I'm just saying. Why is everyone falling for this? Well, people, my friends of mine who are holistic, you know, are asking me, do you think I should get a flu shot? I'm thinking, these are people who live like Birkenstock people, you know, that live really naturally and that eat really clean, and it's that brainwashing thing.
Well, I'll weigh in here. I think it's very overwhelming for people to fathom that there is a matrix and the matrix would do something this this is, yeah. In other words, and the funny thing is, you know, I come at everything in terms of how does the money work? What are the financial issues? And I was just talking with Paul Ferguson, our treasurer, earlier, and describing the debt clock. There's a debt clock now on the web that counts up the amount of debt per person in America, and the national debt is almost up to $40,000 per person, but the contingent liabilities of Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security are up to $191,000 per person. For a total of about almost $250,000 per person. So there's a tremendous need on the economic and political side to assert very dramatic control of the population as the benefits that everybody is expecting get cut. So, you know, I just see incredible economic pressure to do something to fear and control, you know, to frighten and control the population. And it's a lot easier to have a bank holiday under the guise of a flu than it is to have a bank holiday under the guise of an economic crisis. Mm. I mean, you can program in all sorts of manipulations of the economic system under the guise of, you know, you can basically have martial law without having martial law.
Mm.
So, yeah. You know, if you look at the economics of what's going on, and the fact that you have a rushed experimental vaccine and a flu that's not, you know, doesn't seem to be as bad as the flu, the economic issues around this just make it look bad. But I think most people find it overwhelming to face that. It's, you know, it's pretty scary to realize that the machinery is that irrational in terms of your health.
It seems like one of the most blatant examples that that I've ever seen, you know, that, I mean, of something that's totally illogical. Just, you know, what else is happening is all you can think of because it doesn't make any sense.
Well, when you look at the economics, I think it might start to make sense. Well, anyway, Dr. Thompson, thank you so much. If you could just describe... Now, you are available to consult with individuals and families on these issues.
Sure, yeah. I mean, obviously, I have two parts to my practice. The first part is that I take patients for whatever it is that's going on with them that they want to work on. And I do full programs with hormonal testing and, you know, infection testing, viruses, mold, yeast, fungus, bacteria, that type of thing, allergies, and nutritional testing, tests for nutrients, B vitamins, calcium, vitamin C, et cetera. I do all kinds of testing, and then I create customized programs according to what people need. So, you know, basically no two people get the same program. But, you know, I also have an arm of my business that, which is, I suspect is going to become even more popular in the next few years, which is more for acute care. Or, you know, I'll have like a patient that says, you know, I just want to get a program and stay on the program. I don't need to have consults. I can't afford, you know, et cetera. And so I'll just, you know, do whatever I need to do, whatever. Frankly, might sound a little bit presumptuous, but what I do now, and certainly not the way you do it, Catherine, but I always talk to people about their finances. In the first visit, you know, because I want to know that I'm not going to create more stress for them.
Correct.
So I like to create a program that they're going to be able to handle. And so some people will see me once or twice, just get on a program. And I've had a couple of families say, you know, we just want to be able to protect ourselves during this flu season. So, I actually have my biofeedback practitioner here who, refer to, we make customized, like we have this remedy called Flutone to customize it with your saliva sample. Sometimes we even take, you know, a nasal swab or have someone, you know, swab their nose or whatever and make a customized remedy, which is really inexpensive. It's like 25, 30 bucks or something. And, to help you, your body identify the virus in your way, the way your immune system needs to, and eradicate it. So I have all different levels as far as financial commitment in my offerings. And I've developed that especially in the past 6 months because I really like to help people and be out of pain. I mean,
right.
And I'm without suffering. It's just incredible to me that, you know, that so many things could be handled on our own by just making ourselves strong.
Well, that's a perfect description of your practice. Now, people can contact you. All the contact information is on your website, and it's linked from the blog. But if you could just give your website address, that would help.
Okay, yeah. Well, you can go with drlauratompson.com. That's D-R-L-A-U-R-A Thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N.com. Or, for short, Southern California Institute of Clinical Nutrition is actually www.sicn.com.
Okay. Well, Laura, thank you again so much. Have a wonderful
evening. Oh, you're welcome,
Catherine.
Thank you for having me on, and
and good to talk with you guys.
Okay, that was Dr. Laura Thompson. Now we're bringing in attorney Alan Phillips from North Carolina. Alan, are you with us?
I am.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We just talked on July 23rd about a framework for vaccine law and legal exemptions, and maybe you could just give us a one-minute summary. For everybody who hasn't heard it, it's in the archive. You can access from your subscriber panel. Alan is the author of The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, and it's a wonderful overview of the existing framework for vaccine law. So, Alan, maybe a minute or two, if you could give us a summary of what we talked about earlier.
Well, a lot of my concern last month and again, or I guess that's a couple months ago here, we're already in September, and currently concerns the pandemic flu situation. And the concern that if vaccines are mandated in the context of an emergency, that can shift sometimes radically the rights that we have to refuse vaccines and other consequences as compared to what laws and rights and consequences are in a non-emergency situation as it pertains to routine immunizations. So the laws do vary from state to state in both the routine immunization world and the emergency context. But as a sort of a general overview, some of the concerns here in the emergency context, should we see that scenario unfold, is that potentially harmful, fast-tracked swine flu vaccines that are uninsurable, if they're mandated in the context of an emergency, we may not have philosophical and religious exemptions. And I've even seen examples of a couple of laws where there are situations where they throw out the medical exemptions, and that one is kind of mind-boggling to me because I just don't think that would hold up to constitutional scrutiny. But those who refuse vaccines, whether they're doing it because their state would allow an exemption in an emergency context or just because they say, I don't care, I'm not going to do it, are potentially subject to quarantine. And not necessarily in your home. In many state laws, the potential is that someone else could exercise the discretion, probably a local health official and or possibly in conjunction with non-local officials. But in any case, people other than ourselves have the discretion to quarantine us in some location outside of our home, some sort of state facility or potentially, I suppose, a federal facility as well. And a lot of people, myself included, certainly find all these different prospects a little unsettling, if not a lot unsettling. And so the question has arisen for everyone who catches wind of these different concerns, what can we do about this? And a lot of people are suggesting a lot of different things. And I wanted to touch base with you again this evening, Catherine, if I could, to talk about some of the things that I think are more likely to be productive uses of our time and perhaps briefly some of the things that I believe are probably not productive uses of our time.
So right now, most Americans are under state authority in relation to vaccines, and those states, most states have a variety of different exemptions that we talked about last time. The question, before us is the framework going to shift into an emergency? I was wondering if you could just say a few words about the model state emergency legislation that was designed by the CDC in Washington that's being used to encourage the states to kind of change into emergency mode.
Sure. There were a couple of universities, Georgetown University is one of them that I recall off the top of my head, who put together a draft Model State Emergency Health Powers Act 3 months after 9/11, before the end of 2001, in December sometime, they had this together that they did for the CDC. And this was just model law. But the CDC was then urging states around the country to enact this model law, and most states have enacted one part or another of this model law. So the value of looking at the model law is that. It's an example. The actual laws vary from state to state, but we get a feel for what many of them have and the potential there if we look at the model law as an example. And it does allow some of these things that I just mentioned, such as requiring immunizations without exemptions, requiring other kinds of emergency medical treatments in an emergency context, possible isolation and quarantine outside of our homes if the decision is made by a health authority that that's necessary, and a variety of other related things in the emergency context. And the question that arises for many of us is, do these laws go too far in terms of the rights that states that have enacted laws or laws of this nature in terms of the potential imposition on individual rights or individual choices? And when you look at just right below the surface, and what I mean by that is just, you know, one hair's width past the mainstream media into what's going on with this swine flu vaccine development, there are a lot of reasons to be very concerned about the way this is playing out. And your prior guest touched on many of those concerns quite well, so I won't repeat those. But one key point I want to underscore is that perhaps in a sense, having learned their lesson from the 1976 fiasco where the swine flu vaccine that was widely distributed at that time did result in dozens of documented deaths and thousands of people filed lawsuits claiming death or injury from the vaccine. This time around, the federal government has enacted legislation, and Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Sebelius has enacted that option just earlier this summer that leaves the vaccine manufacturers all but immune from any sort of suit or liability should someone experience a serious adverse reaction or God forbid, die from the vaccine. That is really, really disturbing to me. We also have in this country, I don't know if your listeners are aware, we have actually a separate court system, a vaccine court system that deals with vaccine injuries, and where there's a potential in a system where people who are claiming injuries, death or injury from a vaccine, may be awarded compensation. But it only compensates vaccines that are on a list. For example, it's my understanding that Gardasil was recently added to that list. I was very glad to see that because I've heard of lots of problems with the Gardasil vaccine. The pandemic flu vaccines are not on that list unless they've added it in the last couple of days, because I checked on that recently. And I don't know of any plan at this point to add them.
One of the questions I'd asked you, and this came in from one of our subscribers, was the suggestion that if, because I have friends who are doctors and nurses, and they're being told that they're going to have to take the vaccination and, of course, don't want to. The question from the subscriber was, can they notify their workplace if there's any side effects from taking this, that this will be a workman's compensation issue? So is there a way to get compensated under workman's compensation for those who are required by the workplace to take this?
I thought, first of all, that was a very clever idea, and you're the one who actually brought that to my attention. I'm not a workers' compensation attorney, so I can only speak in sort of general terms to that, but it's certainly my understanding. Workers' compensation is a law that varies from state to state, so it may be, again, one of those varies from state to state kind of questions, but it's certainly my understanding that many employers, especially larger ones, do share directly some part of the cost, or in some cases even all of the cost of claims. So if it is true that a vaccine that's required as a condition of employment, if it is true that then an injury from the vaccine would fall under workers' compensation, that's a question that's going to go to at least some employers' bottom line. So I think with regard to a question of what can healthcare employees who are facing this, and this is happening by way of law in New York and by way of policy in hospitals around the country, I'm getting calls on emails on a daily basis pretty much now, and recently from nurses primarily, but healthcare employees saying, what can we do? So part of the answer to the what can we do question there may be to raise this question about possible workers' compensation claims for workplace injury by way of the vaccine. And that might cause some of these hospitals who are doing this as a policy issue to reassess their policy. I think it's a...
The institutions, for example, schools and doctors are non-exempted. It's only the vaccine makers. So they continue to have liability, don't they?
I don't think so. I mean, I really don't think there's anybody that has liability unless some law is enacted that would, at this point, create that liability, or if it, unless it were added to the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program list of vaccines. I don't think there are any private insurance companies out there that are going to insure vaccine injuries. That was my understanding years ago when I first started exploring the vaccine, larger vaccine question. So, again, as far as I know, now, you know, I tell you, I'm on a fast-track learning curve in recent weeks and months on this issue, and I'm learning new information daily. For example, I just learned this morning that here in North Carolina, if there was a quarantine order and you violate that, you are subject to potentially up to 2 years of incarceration for doing that. I can see the logic of that in a really severe, hypothetical, severe, highly contagious, highly virulent disease, virus or disease or what have you. But with something that is so benign as the swine flu, I mean, I'm hearing reports that are saying it's really no more dangerous than the seasonal flu. So why all the hype about this, you know, that Massachusetts law, for example, why are people taking such a frantic, hard line in many cases about this? It's just the logic escapes me.
One of the challenges that many of us have in when we say, look, there's no emergency here, there's no reason for a legal emergency, is as a legal matter, the World Health Organization has declared a legal emergency. Is that not correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the sense that they've made this level 6 pandemic declaration, and it's my understanding that there was actually a change in the definition in order to get a disease that is as benign as this would qualify, that previously there was a definition that would require both the wide geographic distribution and a level of virulence that we're not seeing in this particular swine flu. Of course, there's been lots of talk about how it could come back this fall and be deadlier than it has been. I presume that means some sort of mutation involved. Of course, if it does mutate, then that could render any otherwise effective vaccine ineffective. So it's sort of, if it did come back more virulent because of mutation, that would sort of render the vaccines that are under development now pointless. And this is something we see pretty routinely with the seasonal flu vaccines, that the manufacturers have to guess several months in advance which strain is going to be the dominant strain. And many times they guess wrong. You know, not to their discredit, it's just something that's hard to predict in advance, absent a flu crystal ball of some kind. So, but they get it wrong. Of course, they distribute the flu vaccine anyway, the theory there being, well, at least it'll protect against the strain that's not dominant.
Alan, I put up, there's a very interesting article in WorldNet Daily that listed some of the provisions that some of the states are providing, including copies of the quarantine forms that the Ohio state of Ohio is preparing. And, you know, maybe if you could just say a few words about what different states are doing, you know, what is the effort to really get states in a position to declare emergency? We know Massachusetts has this draconian $1,000 a day fee if you, you know, if you refuse a vaccine. What's going on at the state level?
Well, most states have the right under current law to mandate a vaccine, and if they so choose to throw out exemptions in the process and to impose quarantine and isolation and not necessarily in your homes. Whatever actually plays out this fall, I mean, you know, I'm hearing the full hypothetical range of different people's opinions, everything from it's going to blow over. Nobody's going to be sick. There's, you know, or there's not going to be any increase in deaths or anything like that. And to the another extreme of people who are in the wild conspiracy end of the spectrum, who fully expect that there will be millions dead this fall from the vaccine, primarily people in one of a variety of different so-called conspiracy theories. My concern is not so much trying to figure out what is going to play out, but rather that any of the variety of so-called worst-case scenarios that might happen in terms of imposed vaccine and quarantine and isolation and so forth, these are things that can happen pursuant to current law. And whether it plays out or not this fall, it could play out again the next time around. And so the problem doesn't go away. In other words, the problem is sort of independent, in a sense, of whatever the actual play out becomes. And so from my point of view, that's the problem. The primary problem is that this is what laws allow. And so the primary response needs to be to change policy and law so that that overreaching that's available on the part of the state is curtailed, it's cut back, so it's not there. Now, changing laws,
so
of course...
In many respects, it seems to me this is a time to know your state and local representatives and to be in communication with them and the organizations that are trying to impact state policy.
Absolutely.
It's really a state issue right now.
Absolutely. Well, first and foremost, I mean, as we discussed earlier before the call, the World Health Organization, at least as a starting point in terms of the technical jurisdictional boundaries, the World Health Organization and even our own federal government doesn't have the authority to reach directly into the states and impose or require vaccines directly on state residents. That authority will come ultimately, as I understand it, from the state level. Even if there's a national emergency declared by the current administration, it will be individual states that will declare a state emergency or not and mandate the vaccines or not. So the primary response then I think needs to target state policy and lawmakers. And I see we're getting close to time here, so I just wanted to mention real briefly that I've got some explanation and summary and explanation of that problem and ways to address that at the state level on my vaccinerights.com website. There's a section of the vaccinerights.com site that deals with this pandemic flu problem, and so I encourage folks who would like to get more information than we'll have time to discuss tonight, send them to that site to look at that. We have templates, letters, and components that people can use if they wish to communicate with state leaders to see if we can't change over the short term policy and then subsequently laws so that we cut back these states' rights to a more acceptable level.
So basically what we should be doing is checking out, it's pandemicfluonline.com.
Pandemicfluonline.com is a great resource for kind of staying up on the latest news events.
Right.
A really good source. And I have some of that on my site as well. I have a news section where I'm posting mostly these days pandemic flu-related.
So we should go to vaccinerights.com and look in the problem solutions. It's where we've got the template letters, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And then news, and then pandemicfluonline.com.
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, now if someone wants to contact you, the contact information is on your website?
Yes, it is, the bottom of every page.
Okay. Should I ask you what your plan is to do, your personal plan to avoid the vaccine?
Well, I'm organizing a state-level communication letter-writing campaign here in North Carolina, and I encourage other folks to do the same thing and feel free to stay in touch with me and us, and we can all share notes because there's no prescription out there for exactly how to do all of this, although the legislative process generally is fairly well established by other procedures over the many years. But
are you going to, the information, the letters you're writing, are you going to have those up on your web so that somebody can kind of use it, poach it for their state?
Yes, I do have not only my own letters that I'm drafting and working with other people to draft and revise, but links to letters that people in other states have written as well. So there's examples there for folks to look at and see.
Ellen, you're so wonderful.
Well, thank you so much. Well, I can't tell you how much I learned listening to your show tonight. I'd love to come back just because I know I'm going to learn something fabulous every time I do, and it's a real...
Well, that's why we have to stay in cahoots, because, you know, as this thing is, as sort of the beast is rolling this out, we all have to kind of figure it out and transform it. We have to compost the, you know, the... It's a little bit like judo. We have to redirect the energy into something a little bit more positive. So
there you go.
It's imperative to keep talking about it, even though it's, you know, it can be an unpleasant subject. But it's by talking about it that I think we take the fear out of it and see the opportunity to shift and shift the whole thing. So
absolutely.
I can't thank you enough because I, to me, the very precise and impeccable details of the law and how the law works is going to be critical to any kind of shift or successful effort in this whole area. So
I couldn't agree more.
I can't thank you enough for all your work, Alan, and you have a wonderful evening, okay?
Thank you so much, Kim.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, coming up next on September 10th, we have the Precious Metals Update with Franklin. We're in a real strategic inflection point in the precious metals market and also in the U.S. dollar market. With the big treasury auctions next week, this is going to be very interesting. So please join us on the 10th. And then on the 17th, a wonderful Soleri report, Money is Spiritual Practice with Mayori Onoheim. It's going to be a fascinating discussion because part of what we need to navigate uncertain financial times is to really integrate all aspects of our lives, our values with our money. And so a critical conversation to kind of jumping the curve on what's going on in the fall. And then October 1st, our third quarter wrap-up. These are some of my favorite to do. I do an annual wrap-up and quarterly. We're going to look at where we are, where we're going. And as change accelerates during the fall, it's critical to maintain that long-term perspective because part of successful strategies is aligning ourselves and our assets with where things are going in the long run. So thank you so much for joining us for a little bit extra longer show, Swine Flu Doubleheader, Laura Thompson and Alan Phillips. Don't ever say people aren't doing anything. We have just immensely talented and courageous people like Laura and Alan just doing everything they can to make sure we're safe and we have options. So, again, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.